Catherine Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and a few years ago, she developed what some might call an unhealthy obsession with a topic most of us like to avoid. The subject matter in question was the state of mind we call being wrong about something, anything. It is nothing if not human to be wrong sometimes, but we prefer not to dwell on that. Schultz decided to face the music head on. She ended up writing a book about it. And in a TED Talk related to her book, Schultz begins the conversation with a thought experiment of sorts. She asks the audience, what does it feel like to be wrong? What does it feel like to be wrong? Most of us can fill in the blank. It feels awful to be wrong, uncomfortable, embarrassing, devastating even. All the more so for the type A folks among us, those of us who are used to being the experts in our respective fields. Maybe you are one such person. Or maybe you simply learned the embarrassment of being wrong in public, in a classroom when you were young, and thereafter decided, never again. Schultz, however, points out something that we might miss. That awful feeling in the pit of your stomach, that embarrassment at being wrong, is not actually what it feels like to be wrong. That is what it feels like to find out that you are wrong. Being wrong, before the wrongness becomes evident to us, before the surprising revelation that we were blissfully ignorant or sadly mistaken, being wrong tends to feel an awful lot like being right. We spend most of our lives feeling like we are right, even when we are wrong. Schultz's point is annoyingly, frustratingly simple. To discover our wrongs, we must develop a healthy sense of doubt. To properly take stock of when we might be wrong, we must first admit that we might be wrong about what we think is right. Today, in our gospel passage, we meet a smart guy, a lawyer type, a person who is used to thinking and feeling that he is oh so right. He shows up to cross-examine Jesus, to catch him off guard and embarrass him in front of the crowds that hang on his every word. Jesus will have none of it. Instead of giving him an answer, he asks some questions. Instead of making a case for himself, he tells a story, a parable. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers. So begins the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know how this story goes. Before we get to the Good Samaritan, however, let me say a few words about parables themselves. Though parables are associated with the Christian tradition, it is important to remember that the original teachers and hearers of these stories were Jewish. The Talmud, the comprehensive collection of rabbinic teachings on the Torah, the five books of Moses at the beginning of our Old Testament, provide some insight into a parable's meaning and function. Do not let the parable appear of little worth to you, the Talmud reads. Through a parable, a person can fathom the words of Torah. Consider the king who has lost a gold coin or a precious pearl in his house. May he not find it by the light of a wick worth no more than a penny? The parable is that tiny wick, that small candle, a teaching tool, a metaphor in the form of a story that helps us understand what is most important in the moral life. It is not meant to replace the law, but rather, as the Talmud suggests, it sheds light on it. The parable delves into the core values of the law so that we may better understand its meaning. The Good Samaritan is one such story, one of the most well-known parables Jesus tells in the Gospels. After all, we name hospitals and nonprofit organizations after the Good Samaritan. The story is embedded so deeply into our collective psyche that many of us would be hard-pressed to remember the moment we first heard it. With a parable like this one, familiarity works against our understanding. We know this story too well. We know the lesson it is supposed to teach us. To understand what the parable of the Good Samaritan means for us today, we must recover its strangeness. We must hear it again, as if for the first time. We must hear not what we already know to be right, but what it could teach us about what we still get wrong. Are you with me here? A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers. Now, we do not know the identity of the man who was robbed, though given the audience, it would be safe to assume that the victim was Jewish. We do find out a bit more about those who pass him by. Since the priest and the Levite are the first to walk by, a popular view among some commentators is to say that these religious folks avoided the man due to ritual purity concerns. But there is nothing in this text that suggests that. The priest and the Levite are going away from Jerusalem, not toward it. In other words, they are not headed to the temple for priestly service of any kind. And the law did not prohibit a priest from saving a life or burying a corpse. The idea that the priest's reticence to help has to do with ritual purity codes from the Old Testament is rooted in our mistaken assumptions about Jewish legalism, not anything that we find in the story itself. Rather, the point Jesus is trying to make here has to do with the Jewish community as a whole. In the first century context, Jewish people fell roughly into three groups: priests, descended from Aaron, Levites, descended from the tribe of Levi, and the rest of the Israelites, those descended from Jacob's other sons. After the priest and the Levite walked by, the crowd would assume that an Israelite would follow. The surprise, of course, is that the third is not a kinsman, but an enemy, a Samaritan. Samaritans and Israelites lived next door to one another for centuries, but despite a common heritage, the two nations were well-known enemies. Culturally, they differed on many of the essentials: a different location for their temple, a different version of the Torah, a different line of priests. In the parable, Jesus turns neighborly relationships upside down. It is a Samaritan, the Israelites' enemy, who stands in the gap, providing care for one of their own, a Jewish victim, while members of their own community pass the buck. And yet, that is not all. This is not the most surprising element of this story. To understand that, we must go back to the beginning of our passage, to the question that prompted Jesus to tell this parable in the first place. "And who is my neighbor?" the lawyer asked. Note that Jesus never really answered the question. Jesus didn't establish the identity of those whom we ought to consider neighbors. He didn't describe arbitrary bounds for our concern, prioritize neighbors in terms of their geographic, social, or political distance from us. Jesus will have none of that. Instead of defining who our neighbor is, Jesus spends his time describing what a neighbor does. Instead of defining who falls within the scope of our concern, he describes how we should love one another, going out of our way to welcome and care for not just the stranger, but those whom we perceive to be outright enemies. If you think you understand what a neighbor is, if you think that you get the point of this passage, then think again. Jesus will always stand there, point to the person that stands at the very edge of your ability to love, and then he will invite you to love the person that comes after them. And when the world asks you to rank your neighbors, when it tries to divide groups into insiders and outsiders, the citizen and the foreigner, those who deserve our help and those who don't, Jesus will remind you that he refuses to play such games with people's lives. In the Christian way of life, you cannot define your neighbor. You can only be one. Jesus concludes his story, not with a statement, but a question. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? The lawyer replied, the one who showed him mercy. Amen. That is all there is to this story, folks. Let us go and do likewise. Thank you.